Zoom meeting. So there's those of us who are here in the Nolan Center, and then there's a number of other people who are also, is that okay? Thanks. there's a number of other people that are joining us via the World Wide Web using Zoom meeting technology. So for those of you who are joining us on the Zoom meeting, it's great to see you. And we'll get going right now. So the coronavirus vaccine, we're going to talk about how does it work? How effective is it? What are the side effects? Is it safe? And a little bit about how was it developed and how did this happen so quickly? So this is a colorized electron microscope image of the coronavirus. And you can see the yellow here is a lipid bilayer sheath. And then there are these other colors. There's the purple and the green and the blue. And those represent proteins that are floating in the sheath of the virus. And what's most important here is this triangular shaped protein called the spike protein. This is the protein that the virus uses to attach to a cell in the respiratory tract. And it is also the protein that our body, when we form an immune response to the virus, our body recognizes the shape of that protein in forming the antibodies that we direct at the virus. So this is all very important to the function of both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. So this is a messenger RNA vaccine. So what is messenger RNA? Messenger RNA is a molecule that's found in every one of the cells in your body. And it's a molecule that exists in a cell to direct the cell to produce some product, to manufacture a protein. And so that's something that's going on in the metabolism of our cells all the time. So what is special about this little piece of messenger RNA is that it contains the instructions for producing the spike protein from the coronavirus. So it's like a teacher, and it goes into the cell and it instructs the cell how to build little pieces of that spike protein. It doesn't teach the cell to make the virus. It doesn't teach the cell to do anything else. It just teaches the cell to produce those little spike proteins that I just showed you the picture of. So then, how is that helpful? Well, you'll see here on the picture that once those spike proteins are produced, that the body responds to that protein and produces an antibody. What is an antibody? Antibody is basically the weapon that our immune system uses to eliminate foreign intruders. So now this person who has received these instructions, produced those spike proteins, has produced those antibodies, and now that person's immune system knows how to react if they get exposed to the wild virus. So now when the virus comes into their body, those antibodies attack it and prevent them from getting sick. The patient receives two doses of the vaccine over a 3 to 4 week period, and the second dose of vaccine boosts the immune system's ability to produce more and more of those antibodies so that the immunity lasts, that it's not just a brief few months that they have the immunity, but now they have enough of the antibodies to last for quite a long time. We don't know exactly how long, but it certainly greatly increases the amount of immunity that the person has and its effectiveness. So we say now that they're immune to the virus. So they have not been exposed to the virus, but they have the antibodies in their body to fight it if it were to show up. How effective is the vaccine? So it's highly effective. This is a highly effective vaccine. It is 95% effective at preventing clinical disease. That means disease where you would get sick, you would need to be hospitalized, or you would die. So its effectiveness against asymptomatic disease has not been proven, but as we are now vaccinating millions of people, the CDC is collecting that information, and early indications are that it is strongly effective at preventing asymptomatic disease, but the jury is still out and just how effective that is. So this is a graph that shows the cumulative incidence of COVID-19 for the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine. The data from that trial is similar. So this is from the phase 3 trial, which is the point at time where they're actually doing a placebo-controlled study to look at the effectiveness. So they've already, at that point in the development of the vaccine, they've already proven that the vaccine is safe. And they have also proven that the immune system will respond to the vaccine. And now they want to see how effective is it at actually preventing. So they take the study participants, divide them into two groups. One group gets a placebo, which is they get a shot of salt water. There's no vaccine in it. And then the other group gets the actual vaccine. And then they watch them through time. And so when they did that, you can see time here on the bottom axis, and then here going up this axis is people getting sick with coronavirus. And you can see the red line represents people who received the placebo, the salt water. And you can see they continue to get sick with coronavirus. The blue line is the group who received the vaccine. So over the first 10 days following the administration of the vaccine, you see that they're getting sick at the same rate as the placebo, and then their line gets flat. And the flatness there represents the fact that they're no longer getting sick as time goes on. There's very, very, very few cases in the vaccinated group of the coronavirus occurring. Side effects of the vaccine. A sore arm, pretty universal. Most people have a sore arm following this vaccine. Headache and fever. In the phase 3 trial, the incidence of headache and fever was low. It was less than 5% of all those who received the vaccine. Fatigue is much more common. About half of everyone who received the vaccine, especially the second shot, experienced fatigue. Muscle pain and joint aches are also fairly common, about half of all people. The duration of these symptoms is short, however, universally resolved within 36 hours. Very uncommon for it to go longer than that. And in our experience, vaccinating thousands of people around Southeast Alaska, that's been our experience as well. Severe allergic reactions are given the term anaphylaxis. And presently worldwide, we're seeing an incidence of about 10 of those for every million vaccine doses given. So what is anaphylaxis? That's a situation where there's cardiovascular collapse and people develop hives and swelling, and you can die from that. Now, we see anaphylaxis in clinical practice of medicine on a regular basis. And it is something that we're prepared to deal with, and we treat it successfully. We use epinephrine, Benadryl, Solu-Medrol are the medications most commonly. And I, over the course of the last 30 years, have treated people for this, having seen it occur with people who've been given penicillin and other antibiotics, people who've been given blood pressure medicines, people who've been given rheumatoid arthritis medications, people who've been given chemotherapy medications. Anytime we give medications, particularly serious, significant types of medication, there is a chance of a patient having an anaphylactic reaction. So the rates that we're seeing of anaphylaxis for this vaccine are consistent with the types of rates of anaphylaxis we've seen with other vaccines in the past. This is an extremely safe vaccine. This is not a live virus vaccine. So sometimes we use a live virus for the that causes the disease when we create a vaccine, and that virus is attenuated or weakened, and then it will produce a very mild form of the disease that then makes the patient immune. So an example of that would be the vaccine that many of us received when we were children for smallpox. Now we no longer give that vaccine, but that's an example of an attenuated virus vaccine. Another example of this would be the chickenpox vaccine. So this vaccine, as I mentioned earlier, is a messenger RNA vaccine. And so there's no, there's absolutely no way that it can cause the coronavirus disease or any other disease. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the vaccine enters cells to produce the spike protein, and then what happens to it? It's degraded. It's degraded the same way that all the other messenger RNA in your body is degraded. So in our cells, we are constantly recycling RNA molecules. And so it doesn't last very long. It just lasts for a few days and then it's completely gone. It's another reason why we have to give the booster shot, to give people another dose so their body can see a little more of it and produce a more robust immune response. There have been a lot of people who said, oh, this is going to alter my genetics. It is not possible for a messenger RNA molecule to alter your DNA. In the genetic movement of material within a cell's metabolism, it moves from the DNA in the nucleus outwards into the cytoplasm where messenger RNA lives. There is no reverse transcriptase or other enzyme that's capable of moving messenger RNA instructions upstream into DNA. So that's not a possibility. So it cannot become DNA or alter the DNA of your cells. So one of the things that is kind of interesting is how could we possibly have produced a vaccine that's effective and safe in as little as 9 or 10 months time? And I think there's a number of things that have been going on that have not been part of our common awareness, but are part of what's going on in science. And Aaron, I'm wondering if there's some water that would be helpful to me. Thank you. and one of them is our previous work on this virus and this family of viruses. So you may or may not remember that about 7 years ago, there was a severe respiratory distress virus that really had most of its effects in Southeast Asia. Never really made it to North America, but there was a lot of concern around the globe that would turn into a pandemic. Now, that was a coronavirus, very, very, very similar to this. And at that time, there was a huge amount of effort directed at developing a vaccine to that virus, which never ended up being used because of the fact that it never turned into a pandemic. It was controlled through public health measures like masks and distancing and things like that. So all of that vaccine work was on the shelf. The next thing is that there, in spite of what you might hear, there actually is a very robust world of scientific cooperation. So when the virus that's causing this pandemic, which is SARS-CoV-2, was first encountered in China, it was genetically sequenced, and that genetic sequence was shared internationally among scientists by March. So one of the most time-consuming and difficult aspects of developing a vaccine like this is actually having the actual sequence of the genetic code for the virus. The third thing that's going on here is the incredible scientific advancement that we've seen in immunology and genetic sciences in the last in the last two decades, and particularly in the last 10 years. You may not be necessarily aware of that. However, if you know somebody who's been receiving treatment for cancer or rheumatoid arthritis, you know somebody who's been benefiting from this technology. This technology has become the central technology in the development of medications for many childhood diseases, for many diseases of the bones and the cartilage, for many forms of cancer, including breast cancer, colon cancer. So this is really, it's really just transforming medicine very rapidly. And we're going to continue to see more vaccines and more medications that are based on genetic and immunological technology. Really, the government did an outstanding thing when they created Operation Warp Speed, which created a financial security really for the vaccine development companies, so that they knew that if they developed these vaccines, there would be a market for the vaccine, and that if their vaccine development efforts were not successful, they would still get paid for the work that they were doing. One of the things that happened after the SARS-CoV-1 epidemic was that many of the vaccine developers during that time spent millions and even billions of dollars trying to prepare a vaccine for SARS-CoV-1. It was never used, and those companies ended up having huge financial losses. And then the last thing I'll speak about is an FDA program called the Emergency Use Authorization. And you may or may not have heard that these vaccines have been given an emergency use authorization. And what the heck is that? So the actual process of developing a vaccine oftentimes requires years in order to do the phase three studies. So how could they have done those phase three studies so quickly? Well, the reason they've been able to do them quickly is that that virus is out in the communities and causing disease to thousands and millions of people. And so it creates an environment where you can give the vaccine to people, do the trial, and very quickly see if the vaccine actually works. oftentimes when we're vaccinating for diseases, they're diseases that are fairly rare. And you would have to give it to a lot of people and wait many years to see if those vaccines are actually effective. So the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic actually makes it quite a bit easier to test a possible vaccine once it's been developed. The FDA came under a lot of criticism back in the 80s and 90s when I was doing my training. When I was doing my training in Denver, on an average night of call when I was a medical student or a resident, we would admit anywhere from 6 to 10 people with AIDS, and those young men would die. I mean, I remember watching hundreds and hundreds of young men die from AIDS when I was in my training. And there were drugs that were being developed that could have been effective for HIV. And now we have those drugs and they are extremely effective. But when they were first developed, no one could use them. There were trials that were showing that they were effective, but if you had HIV, you couldn't get access to them. So there was a really big political push against the FDA and said, look, if there's a drug that's been shown that it's safe and it's promising, you need to have a program that allows for it to be authorized for emergency use while it's still being studied. And that's really when the program got started. And so the FDA is able then to license, medications and laboratory studies and vaccines using that program. So every single test that we do in this country right now for COVID is licensed under an emergency use authorization. Most of the, I mean like the laboratory tests that we're using and so on. So most of those, it will probably take another year or longer before they're actually fully authorized. Is that a problem? No, it's not. It says, this is a unique circumstance. There hasn't been a pandemic like this in almost 100 years. There's really no one in living memory has experienced this. So this is the kind of time when this is an appropriate way to license a vaccine. So when these are developed, there's three stages that are used in the clinical trials. So small groups of healthy volunteers in stage one, larger groups of hundreds of people in stage two, we're looking at both safety and effectiveness in the target group. And then the stage three trials are very large groups of volunteers in the target group of individuals. And for this vaccine, that's everybody over age 16 or 18. And then test and control groups. And this looks at both the effectiveness, the side effects, and the safety. So for the Moderna vaccine, the stage three trial was 30,000 people, and for the Pfizer vaccine, 43,000 people. So those are very large trials. And that really is how the vaccine could be developed in such a rapid manner. So sequencing guidelines have been a source of a lot of problems around the country. In terms of, you know, who should be in the front sequence of the vaccine and who's next. The Center for Disease Control came out with their sequence. The state of Alaska has lagged behind in terms of publishing their sequencing. And SEARCH has built a robust sequencing guideline based on the guidelines from the Center for Disease Control. And based on our articulated values, which include respect for traditional Native culture, and we have prioritized vaccinating our elders and also included the vaccination of our hospital staff and our clinic staff and our EMS, fire and safety, and then also those people that are medically vulnerable, that have diseases or medical problems that put them at higher risk of serious disease, and then our frontline essential workers. In most of our search communities at this juncture, we have vaccinated well down into the 50-year-olds and also our medically vulnerable patients. As of today, we have given the first vaccine to 680 different people here in the community of Wrangell. And about half of those people have completed their second vaccine. And we have vaccinated over 70% of our staff in our hospitals and facilities. Our vaccine outreach has included a really pretty effective process where someone who is interested in receiving the vaccine can use their phone to scan this QR code that's on the lower right portion of this slide. Once they do that, they will be given a form that they can fill out that includes their demographic information. And as long as it has a valid email, we're really able to make things work. Then they receive an email that gives them a link that they can use to make an appointment for a vaccination. For those folks who don't have a smartphone or don't have access to the internet, we've been recommending that they contact the clinic directly, and folks in the clinic will help them to get that sorted out. So, immunity peaks 2 weeks after the second shot. The shot prevents hospitalization and death. The effects on asymptomatic spread are unproven, but promising. Personal activity can increase with caution. So this, once you've had the shot, this doesn't mean that you need to throw all the COVID-19 precautions out the window, but if you're an individual who is in a highly susceptible group, for example, an older person who maybe has been living at home for the last few months completely, I think with proper masking and maintaining social distance, you can do things like going out into the community to do chores or going to purchase some food at the store. We continue to recommend use of the mask, social distancing, good hand hygiene until the pandemic abates. And we expect that it's going to be well into the summer before we get to a point where we've vaccinated at least 70% of the population. So that's our goal. Is to get over 70% in all of our communities, and we're making strong progress in that direction. So that is my presentation today. Good. So maybe what we could do is that I could, at this point, move the control of the meeting to one of you folks, and you can assist with questions from people that are attending. I don't know, is that possible, Cindy? Let's see. Or do I go, who is it, Esther or? Right. Just take a pause here. Yeah. So a lot of times it's helpful when I've been doing these meetings, if you have a question, you could, if you're here in the Nolan setting, you could raise your hand and I'll call on you, and then I'll repeat your question for people that are in the Zoom meeting. And if you're in the Zoom meeting, well, you could use the chat. And then Esther can assist you with getting those questions to me. Does that sound okay, Esther? I asked the people who are in the Zoom meeting could, like, if they have questions, put them in the chat, and then you can look at those and help me to identify them. Yeah. So questions. Yes, sir.
Far be it for me to not ask a question. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming. Quite formative.
Thank you for having me.
I've looked at it for myself, for my wife, for my children, and I have a couple of questions about sort of the side effects of the knowns and unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have one, if I could. I'll wrap the first two together. And then the last one is on another subject, which is therapeutic. Because I've asked this question, the therapeutics question, three times. I've asked this question on the therapeutic three times in city council meetings with church representatives present and haven't received any answer on it. If you can enlighten us on the therapeutics, that would be great. But the first question, two questions, have to do with side effects. And I researched it fairly thoroughly and read a lot of the opinions from other medical and there was in the SARS vaccine search, they had problems that were unanswered. It was a similar search to this vaccine. Of course, I realize this is an experimental vaccine. I get that. But it's not an experimental pandemic. I get that too. Okay. But there were questions about reproductive harm. Yes? Yes, there he is. There are questions about potential reproductive harm, childbearing age, to do with layers of the placenta. They weren't answered with the SARS vaccines, and that was one of the things that made why they stepped in that, and of course, the fact that was a question. And the other man put glasses on to read. Also, there was a question of antibody-dependent enhancement in immunosuppression and the term that could possibly last from this kind of vaccine. Now, I actually don't know if that exists as to your accumulation about a messenger vaccine. I realize that's a new entity. But if you could enlighten us on either one of those subjects about potential reproductive harm or the immune dependent possibilities. And some of the SARS tests, you know, I'm not going to say that. That's a real negative in this event. So if you can enlighten us on either one of those, it'd be great.
Sure. Thank you for those questions. So let's start with the concerns about the potential effect on reproduction. So the concern was raised not out of any study that was done on these vaccines, but out of a theoretical concern that the spike protein on coronavirus shares some of the same shape characteristics and size as proteins that are found in the human placenta. So it was hypothesized that perhaps the vaccine would cause an immune response that would be directed at the placenta. So there is nothing that has existed in the phase 3 trials that would indicate any effect on people's ability to reproduce. So there were women in both the placebo arm and the vaccine arm of the phase 3 trials of both of these vaccines who became pregnant and who ended up completing successful pregnancies with normal rates of success and miscarriage. So that is direct evidence that the vaccines do not cause a problem. There's also, when you think about the fact that the concern is a theoretical concern. And so if you carry that forward, if the protein that's found in the placenta is analogous to the spike protein that's in the capsule of the virus. Then a woman who has an exposure to COVID-19 will develop antibodies to the virus spike protein. And if there is a cross-reactivity between that protein and the protein that's in the placenta, then those antibodies should be attacking those proteins in the placenta, and we should see a clinical effect. That is to say, we should be seeing women who are infected with COVID-19 should be losing their babies. It should be actually manifest as a spectrum of the existing COVID-19 disease, and it is not. So there are millions of women who have contracted COVID-19 all around the world, and there are many hundreds of thousands of those women who have been pregnant, and there's not been an observed effect on their ability to complete their pregnancy. So although I understand that this could be a theoretical concern because of the geometric similarities between those proteins, it's not a similarity that's manifesting as an element of the COVID-19 spectrum of disease. So therefore, it is logical that it's not really a valid concern. So that's how I feel about it. And I think there's a lot of other medical experts around the country who share that perspective. So moving on to the immune reaction to the vaccine, once the spike proteins are produced, the immunological response to those spike proteins is actually quite complex, quite a bit more complex than just simply the production of antibodies, although the humoral immunity that I've described in my presentation today is without a doubt the most important aspect of that. But the immune system's response to viruses and bacteria is much more complex than just humoral immunity. There's also cellular immunity. So there's natural killer cells that are also upregulated in the response to the vaccine. So pieces of the spike protein are processed by T cells and are presented to natural killer cells, and the natural killer cells then generate a cellular-based immunity. So what is the resonant time of that immunity? It's impossible to know. This vaccine's only existed for five or six months. So although the phase three trials are completed and, you know, we continue to observe the long-term response of recipients of the vaccine, all indications are that it's safe.
Thank you. Last question. There was an example from the SARS vaccine that I decided not to say because there's no fear out there already. It's just not worth repeating. The last question. Last question that I've asked several times here in town during council meetings and stuff is about therapeutics, and there just absolutely is no answer from CIRCE or any representative every single time I ask the question. And there's questions about, of course, hydroxychloroquine, that's the big one, and zinc and others. America's frontline doctors believe that therapeutic applied at the beginning of symptoms, not asymptomatic, but at the beginning of symptoms, is extremely beneficial. And some of the media have been naysayers, not other medical groups on that. But that's not the question. The question is there any therapeutic capability with CIRCE in Wrangell and Southeast? And that would be my question. What is the therapeutic capabilities of our facilities?
Well, it's a really great question, and there have been a number of efforts to identify, so I'll just clarify for everyone else. The question is not about vaccine. It's about what do you do when somebody has COVID-19 or has been strongly exposed to COVID-19, and is there a therapeutic intervention that would be effective at either treating COVID, the COVID-19 infection, or aborting the infection. So it's been an area of intense study, and the studies have shown some small therapeutic benefit to a number of things, including zinc and hydroxychloroquine, and actually azithromycin, all have shown some small amount of responsiveness. However, the emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration for hydroxychloroquine was withdrawn. And the reason for that was really not because of the fact that the that entity doesn't have some demonstrated positive effects. The problem is hydroxychloroquine has some very dangerous and significant side effects. So taken it, a lot of drugs that we, every drug that we prescribe, you can take at some point too much and it'll kill you or it'll make you sick. So there's a toxic level of taking the medication. And then there's also amount that you can take that it won't do anything. It won't help you at all. And so then the range in between those, we call the therapeutic index. It's basically what is the amount of space between the lower dose and the higher dose that will actually give you a therapeutic response. For hydroxychloroquine, that is very, very, very tight. And what are the side effects of hydroxychloroquine when taken in too large of an amount? It prolongs the QT interval, which is the interval between the end of the contractile portion of your cardiac cycle and the repolarization part of that cycle. And when that gets narrow, what happens is that you're subjected to deadly arrhythmias. And that is the main reason that is no longer has an emergency use authorization. I know that wasn't your direct question, but you brought it up and I'm sure you're thinking about it. So really what happened was that the negative consequences of the medication vastly outweighed the positive in balance. At least that was the perception of the experts that were reviewing it. Now, there are a number of things that we do have that are effective in certain circumstances. The first one is solumedrol. So solumedrol and or other medications. You may be familiar in that group. You may be familiar with prednisone. You may be familiar with dexamethasone. And so for patients that are seriously ill with COVID-19, and we have had a number of them in our facilities, we give very, very high doses of these steroids, and they have been shown to shorten the amount of time that somebody is on the ventilator and to reduce the incidence of death. So that's one therapeutic that we have, but it's really only available for people that are deathly ill. Now, for people who have a diagnosis of COVID-19 and are in a high-risk group, but are not seriously ill. So that would be, for example, somebody with heart or lung disease or somebody with diabetes who has COVID-19 and is mildly ill, but does not need oxygen, they are in a group that we are able to give a antibody treatment. So those antibody treatments are given as an infusion, and they are extremely high tech. I mean, this is an antibody that's created with many elements of the same technology that produced this vaccine. And we have those medications and we give those medications. So we have protocols and staff that are capable of giving those medicines, and in the right circumstances, we use them. So at the present time, those are the two main therapeutic interventions that we have. And we all pray that there will be more of them coming down the pike in the near future. So thank you for your questions. Excellent question. Other questions? Yeah.
I wanted to